use of a quantum computer. It doesn't have a speed up which is as impressive as the Shor's algorithm that you saw today, but it's not an exponential speed up, it's a quadratic speed up. But it has a use which is essentially universal. You can apply it everywhere. You don't need any structure, whereas in the case of Shor, you need the structure of the prime numbers. So actually, another name that it has is unstructured database. So you don't need to have any structure in the information that you're looking at in order to use this algorithm. So let me quickly define it. So first of all, what input does it take? Well, the input is some function that goes from the set of n-bit binary strings into some bit. So it's essentially, you can think of it as a Boolean function. And from now on, I'll take large n to be 2 to the n, which is my Hilbert space dimension when I have a Hilbert space. And OK, so I have this function that I think of as a Boolean function. And I should think of the ones as accept or the good strings and the zeros as the bad strings. So then the output that I want for my algorithm is some x such that f of x equals to 1. So any satisfying assignment to this Boolean function. And I'm not going to impose any structure for that function. So in fact, the way I'm going to assume is that every time I want to know something about the function, the only thing I can do is query it. So I can run the function and ask for some value of x whether you get a 0 or a 1. And classically, so let's see what the complexity. So classically, what's the worst case that you can have for such a problem? Well, the worst case, if you want to output an x that satisfies this function, is that there's only one good answer. And it's hidden between this exponential number of bad answers. So you start asking your f for some inputs, and you get no, 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 and until at some point you get a yes. So what's the probability of getting a yes? It's 1 over n. And if you ask it at random, then the typical number of queries to f that you'll have to make is essentially just n. If you're slightly smart, essentially you don't ask the same question twice, then so this is the probability of getting a good answer. And the runtime will actually be see. Will turn out that you cannot reduce it from order n. In fact, you cannot have an expectation value which is smaller than n over 2 if you know that you have just one good answer. OK, so this is pretty bad, especially if n is exponential. For the quantum case, this is what this lecture will be about. Turns out that the number of queries that you need and that you have an algorithm for is actually not n, but it's square root of n. So maybe I should insist that since we are so few people and this is a short topic, you should stop me and ask questions if there's anything that.
Is that proven the fastest you can do in quantum?
That's proven, yeah. And I'll give part of the proof today. Maybe I'll keep this here for now. OK, so without further ado, so the caveat that I need in the quantum setting is that I'll actually need to query this function in a coherent way. So I'll need to have a coherent implementation of that function. So if I have that f, so let me define this unitary antermission operator, which for every ket, so it gives me x if f of x equals 0, and gives me minus x if f of x equals 1. Or in other words, this is minus 1. Simpler notation. Okay, so usually when, maybe you saw this in John's lecture, but when you have an oracle function, when you want to use an oracle for a function f, what you define is some unitary u that, given some input x and some ancilla system A, outputs, still keeps this, the input x, and produces the XOR output on the other side. The reason why people do something like this is that here, independent of whether f is an invertible function or not, this object here is an invertible function in the computational, and it's a permutation, in fact. And this can guarantee that here I have a unitary. So it's something that I might eventually implement in a quantum mechanical way. And OK, so this is essentially the standard construct quantization, let's say, of some function f. And what I wanted to say is that if you have this at your disposal, well, then what you can do is you can take some input x and prepare here the minus state, where minus is defined as this uniform superposition of 0, 1 with the minus phase. So you put some input x, which has some number of registers. The minus has one register. And now you apply this unitary gate uf. And what you get as output is, again, you get the minus state. And here you get this phase gate applied to x. So essentially, if you had access to this guy, then you can really just implement this other unitary by simply putting an ancilla in the minus state. OK, so another operator that we will need is, so this kind of phase operator is, I can also define it for the zero state and say this guy is x and this is actually the same thing as defining that zero as the identity minus two times the projector onto the zero state, where actually in fact what I'm thinking here is that this is the n qubit version of the zero state. OK, and yeah, in general, I can OK, and once I have these two things defined, I'm really ready to define the Grover's algorithm, which has
So what's the relationship exactly between the ZF and the Z0?
Z0 would be Z0. Let's say if I take F equals delta X0, so the function that gives 1 when X is 0 and 0 when X is not 0, then I get this Z0. OK, so Grover's first algorithm. So the first step is to prepare. So we prepare the state plus tensor n, which actually we can prepare by applying Hadamard n times on 0. So let's say for complete list, let me define plus state is this uniform superposition, and the Hadamard gate and it has a 1 over square root of 2 normalization. So this is a unitary and Hermitian. So the first step is to prepare this state, which actually I want to call this capital Psi. And the second step, which is essentially the call of the algorithm, is to apply some gate k times on this capital Psi for some k which we shall to be determined. We'll find it later. This takes us the whole analysis of the algorithm to figure out. And what this g is simply h tensor n z0 h tensor n zf. And what you can convince yourselves is that, in fact, this object here is nothing but the what I defined over there as the z operator with respect to the state psi. Because the Hadamard is taking the 0 to this psi state. And here I have the projector on 0, so this is what I get there. And I still have this zf corresponding to the function that I want to satisfy and check. OK, so it's essentially very simple. It's just these two operations. And the final step is just to measure and, OK, output the result. So now the rest of the time, we will dedicate to actually figuring out what this k is and analyzing this algorithm. Because, I mean, there, I sort of defined it. It's a simple definition, but it's not clear why it works. It's not clear how it works and what k should be. So. So let's define the set A0 to be the non-satisfying string. So it's the x such that this is equal to 0. And similarly, A1, so the complement, so these are the satisfying assignments. Strings. And OK, let's say this guy has alpha 0 elements, and A1 has alpha 1 elements, and we have alpha 0 plus alpha 1 is big N, is this exponential in small n. Now, having these two things defined, we can define states. V0 be a normalized state and similarly for I1 so these are normalized states. And your orthonormal And we will make two observations. The first one is that this capital Psi actually belongs to this I'll call H2, the span of these two states. And the observation is that I can write this psi as a real combination of these two vectors. So this is actually why? Because the way I had defined this this psi capital, it's the tensor product of all these plus states. These have a positive superposition of 0 and 1 everywhere. So this is essentially just 1 over square root of n sum over all possible x's of these computational basis states. OK. So now the observation is that this state, so I can write it in as a sum of these two states. But in fact, during the course of my algorithm, I will never leave this two-dimensional subspace. So this is invariant. So how do we check this? Well, the subspace is actually defined. So let me define this projector as P0. And similarly, P1. And the subspace is defined by the sum of these two projectors. And the observation is that the sum of these two projectors commutes with both Z phi. So why? Because I can, this is essentially a reflection by a vector that lives in this subspace. This is equals to 0. And also commutes with ZF. OK, so I'll never leave this two-dimensional subspace. So I might as well.
So can you elaborate on the reasoning why this?
Why this one or that one or both? First one, for example. Okay.
You gave the argument about the
okay. So what is this said phi? So this is simply an identity. So this term here minus right. So of course the identity commutes. And this psi is a plus 1 eigenvalue of this projector because it's spanned by that subspace. So I have B0 plus phi 1 psi equals. And similarly, so that guarantees commutation. That's it. In the second case, so what I do is I go the other way around. So I can write P1 by 1. And in fact, this guy commutes with both this and this. Why? Because so I have ZF on psi j so these are eigenvalues they're eigenvectors OK, so once I'm in a two-dimensional subspace, I can really just treat it as that. At the risk of boring many of you, I'll do a discretion and introduce the box sphere. So the box sphere is a representation that I can give to states in a two-level Hilbert space. So any state, I can define a density matrix. And this density matrix, I can write it as where these sigma j are the Pauli matrices, so I have sigma x and the property is that for pure states, I get so in general, I have the sum of these coefficients smaller or equal than 1. But these I can think of as the polarizations in the different orthogonal directions. And for pure states, I have polarizations equals to 1. Okay, so where should I? So there's this very nice geometric picture where I put the zero state here, one state. So this is, I should think of a sphere. This plus plus one eigenstate of the sigma x operator. No, sorry. Usually I put plus here, plus I here, minus I, minus. And yeah, all of the pure states are on the surface of this three-dimensional sphere. Mixed states, which are not pure, are in the interior of the sphere. And outside, they're unphysical states. And so what we said is that, OK, we'll have this psi zero state here, this psi one state here, and so I don't need to give a name to the rest of the states, but a state that I do need is my starting state, this psi capital, which is a pure state that lives in this two-dimensional Hilbert space. Right, and now what's the only thing that I can define it such that it has a real it's in this circle. So then the only parameter I need to figure out is this angle theta. So maybe one nice thing I wanted to mention about the box here is that it gets rid of unphysical information such as the global phase of my state. So I might as well have defined this for the zero state or for the e to the I pi zero state. In fact, this is for a density matrix. So the global phases disappear. OK, so what is this? What's this angle here? Well, what will play the role of my sigma z in this picture will actually be this ZF, which will give me a zero eigenvalue for this sector, a one eigenvalue for this sector and a minus one eigenvalue for this sector. So I can use a prescription that I have for the box here, which is that cosine of theta is simply the expectation value . Now I can expand this cosine of theta is approximately 1. like for small angles, which is the setting I'll be interested in. And on this side here, what I will get is so essentially, this state has the uniform superposition of all computational basis states. A fraction alpha 1 over n of them are satisfying. So those are the ones that would correspond to this part here. And the other fraction, so maybe another way of writing this is alpha 0 over n minus alpha 1 over n. But then the point is that I will be in the I will be interested in the regime alpha 1 much smaller than n, which is the hard regime for the problem. It's when I have very few solutions that I am having a hard time to find. So that's why I do this expansion. And then what I get is theta is approximately 2 square root of. That's the angle under this regime of very small alpha. Now, what is this algorithm actually doing? Let me draw it. Let me draw the graph here again. So if you remember, the first step of Grover was to perform this set F, which is essentially reflection around this axis, or actually a rotation by pi around this axis. So if I had theta here, let me call this phi, capital psi, phi 0. I take a reflection. We should do. This takes me here, some state there. Now the second step is a reflection around this original axis of my initial state. Now I'm at this state here. It takes me somewhere here. So this angle is 2 theta. And this is one step of the algorithm. This is applying. This is the G from Grover's. Yeah, it's over there. So first reflection around this axis, then reflection around this axis. I repeat. Now, this vector here, reflected around this axis, goes somewhere here. Prime. This is 2 theta. I repeat again, reflection at state psi. This gives me a new state. Or here again, I have another 2 theta. So what's the total angle corresponding to this state? Well, let me call it theta k. And this is actually 2k plus 1. Data. So the realization is that if you have two reflections make a rotation, and this is, in this case, it's a rotation by 2 theta. Okay, so now what we want is to reach a state close to here. So for that, what we want is we want theta k approximately pi, and for that, we have 2k plus 1 theta And so theta we had figured out, and it was 2 square root of alpha 1 over n. So in fact, the best approximation that I will get is actually to take k where this is the floor. So there I get that after a number of steps, which is proportional to square root of n, not n, I'm getting to, I will get to a vector. So the idea is that I will get some psi k here, which is very close, which has a very high overlap with the solution space. And now I can measure and get a solution with a very high probability. So yeah, maybe here I'll throw in some numbers. So you can. So here I want to describe what the probability is of not getting a solution. So as I said, this is for very large n and small alpha. So actually, these numbers are for alpha 1 for the worst case scenario, which is when there's just one solution. And yeah, so I have 4. So in the case that I have 4 elements, so 2 qubits, I have Grover works exactly. So the angles actually line up such that you arrive exactly at the solution space. But in general, this is not the case. So yeah, I'm going to run out of space. 8, you get 0.06. 4, 32, get 10 to the minus 3, and so on. So this decreases, I think, quadratically with this value of n. OK, so that's, I think we figured out the choice of k. We figured out roughly like the intuition of how what Grover is doing in the Hilbert space, how it's walking. But this doesn't tell you how one would come up with such an algorithm in the first place and why it's optimal. So maybe if you guys are more from high energy or fields background, maybe you're more comfortable with the Hamiltonian formulation. Maybe things will become more apparent. So I could define some Hamiltonian F, which is essentially just, let's say, minus some energy and the projection onto the solutions of the, so PA1, so by this I mean, some Hamiltonian that favors having the solution. And if you have this Hamiltonian, then you can actually implement this set F. I mean, they're actually proportional. So this is just some So I can evolve with this Hamiltonian, and I can implement the oracle that I needed. So now I can ask the problem in the language of, OK, how much time do I need to apply this Hamiltonian in order to figure out what my satisfying states are? In particular, in the case where I have a unique satisfying state. And if I want to do it in the way of just implementing Rober's algorithm, each time I apply this gate, I need a time equals to pi e. So in total, I will need some time equals to pi over e, times the original number of iterations. I'm not counting at all the time I need for all the other circuits. So this was my k, and this is the time I need for each oracle application. So this is some time that will allow me to reach the solution. But now I want to ask the general question of, OK, suppose I want to evolve my system. So let's suppose that f is actually some. Some function with a unique solution omega, then I will define this Hamiltonian omega, h omega of t, as my oracle Hamiltonian. So this is the one that I had here, plus some driving term that I can choose. I can choose and make it time dependent, but it has to be independent of the state, because the state is given in the oracle. It's in the black box, and I don't know what it is. I just want to figure out. I want to figure out what the ground state is of this guy. And in fact, in this picture, it's pretty easy to see what one should be doing in order to get to the final state. So this statement that one can reduce the problem to a two-dimensional subspace still holds. So we have your initial state psi, and one can take two components. So the component that is not satisfying and the component that is satisfying your assignment. And then in this Hilbert space, it's easy to see what kind of rotation you'd want. So you want to take this vector here. So essentially, you want to do a rotation around this axis. A rotation around this axis is a Hamiltonian pointing in this direction. So you have h. So now I should draw Hamiltonians with a different color than vectors, because they're different objects. But so in principle, I have some Hamiltonian h psi, which I can construct. So this is the one favoring the all plus state. So maybe I can think, h phi. And some Hamiltonian favoring this plus one state. If I sum them, I get some Hamiltonian here. So this h, let's take it, equals to h phi plus h w. And now I know that within this subspace, the norm of this Hamiltonian, so let's say here I had theta, here I have theta over 2, and the norm of this Hamiltonian. So if I forget about this E component that I had mentioned before, this will be 2. Okay, so I can think of that I'm actually having a constant driving Hamiltonian and rotating this vector around this axis. And now the second reason for introducing this continuous setting is that it's now easier. It's now easier to prove that Grover is optimal in the sense that I will need at least order square root of n time with my driving Hamiltonian in order to find the hidden state omega. So I had that definition of my driving Hamiltonian with this additional term that is given to me. And what I can define is so I can take some differential equation, essentially take psi omega 0. So I'll take a same starting state. And this state, I will evolve without the additional Hamiltonian, without the H omega. And this state, I will evolve with the driving Hamiltonian and the H omega. So essentially, I will have so Schrodinger equation with that Hamiltonian. And now what I want is that I need these Hamiltonians to sort of separate out these states, which started all equal. And how will I measure how separated the states are? So I will compare them to the state that I obtain without this Hamiltonian term. So I'll take this and so this big T is whenever I declare that I'm done. What I should have is that for that T, so this quantity should be proportional to n. So essentially, I cannot have more than one of these states be close to a reference state, which is omega independent. So this state here on the right is omega independent. If all of these, so what I need is that each one of these states should be approximately equals to its own omega, which is T independent. And I can't have this happen unless unless this distance is proportional to n. And yeah, now what I can look is that I can look at the derivative of this quantity for each component. And I see, okay, so first of all, there's this driving term that is acting on both components of this addition, of this subtraction. And this norm is unitarily invariant. So this driving term doesn't change the norm. And it applies some unitary that doesn't change the norm. And the only change in the norm comes from the action of this term h omega, which only acts here. So what I get is that this is equals to 2 times the imaginary part. And this is in turn smaller or equal than okay, so now if I can write up this, I can define this decomposition of the states into coefficients. So these all possible omegas form some basis. And then what I'm saying is that this, sorry, dt, so this is the derivative of this guy here, which is the sum of these derivatives here. So each term here, will give me 2 a omega, I guess 2 e a omega, because this, the omega component of this state is the only one that that works with this h omega. And I have, due to that, the sum of the coefficients of the wave function cannot be larger than square root of n, because n is my Hilbert space dimension. So this is smaller than 2e square root of n. So now I need to reach a point at time t such that this is proportional to n. The speed of change is proportional to square root of n at most. So I need a time which is proportional to square root of n. So essentially, let's see, but this is just from plugging in the bound on the derivative. So this, what this tells me is that Grover is optimal. So it's optimal in the Hamiltonian setting, but the Hamiltonian setting allowed me to simulate the unitary oracle setting, so I won't be able to do a oracle faster than that. Okay, so maybe now just one observation before I go is there's a slight generalization of Grover's algorithm, which is called amplitude amplification. And this generalization is essentially saying that nobody's forcing us to start with this odd plus state. So essentially what I'll do is substitute what was previously this Hadamard tensor N and substitute it by some arbitrary unitary algorithm. And now I will define my capital psi state as applying this algorithm on the or zero state. And the point is that I can run the whole argument again and say, if this algorithm is a unitary algorithm, I can invert it by inverting all the gates in their order. So I can essentially run the same structure that I had for Grover. I can run it instead of having this Hadamard, having some arbitrary unitary algorithm. And what this tells me is that suppose I wanted to solve a problem where I had this ZF was essentially telling me whether I solved the problem or not. And I cannot solve it with certainty, but I can solve it with some probability P is 1 over, say, polynomial in N. So logarithmic in large N. Then by applying this Grover's algorithm, amplitude amplification, what I can do is I can lift this to a probability of order 1 in a time which is of order, essentially P to the minus 1 half, where P is the success probability. If this probability was exponentially bad, then this won't make the problem efficiently solvable, but it will boost from a partial solution to a complete solution. And maybe the other observation is that this proof of optimality for Grover, it was actually discovered before the Grover algorithm. And the reason why it was discovered is that people were thinking about adiabatic optimization, which is essentially starting from a simple Hamiltonian that has all zero as the ground state and interpolating to a Hamiltonian that has the promise of having an interesting ground state. And the hope was that a quantum computer would have this as a good method for computation. But then this optimality of Grover's algorithm tells us that if one puts arbitrary functions, like point functions that have a unique solution, or Hamiltonians that have only one low energy state and the rest in a flat spectrum, then one will not be able to overcome this exponential difficulty of the problem. OK, that's it. Thank you.